Welcome to Brain Wellness, the podcast. I'm your host, Mandy MP. Each episode will bring you a new topic or interview related to brain health and wellness as part of my mission to help you on the path to a healthier, happier brain. So let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Brain Wellness, the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Jan Canty. Dr. Canty is a psychologist of over 40 years, a homicide survivor, podcast host, author, speaker, consultant, and cancer survivor. She advocates for other homicide survivors and the wrongfully convicted. Quite an interesting introduction. So thank you for being here today. I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation.
Thanks, Mandy, for having me. Appreciate it.
So my first question to people is usually, how did you get interested in this? But I think it's kind of obvious how you got interested. But can you give a little backstory? What happened? What brought you to where you are now?
Yeah, my interest in this kind of was by fate. I set out to be this, but my husband was murdered approximately 40 years ago. Unexpectedly, he was another psychologist and he didn't come home one night. And long story short, he was missing for 10 days. And finally, I got the knock on the door and I was called down to Detroit Police Headquarters and informed they had found his remains located in three different places. And then I was asked to go identify what they did have because DNA wasn't then what it is today. And that was pretty horrific to have to observe that after his remains were buried for 10 days. And then the media descended relentlessly. Just, I can't even begin to describe the treatment from the media, but it was so bad I left his funeral early and eventually left the city altogether, because even after 18, 20 months, they weren't leaving me alone. So I opted to go to the Midwest, where nobody knew me, to a teeny tiny little town, give up everything. I was on the cusp. I had just finished my postdoctoral fellowship, and I was within 10 days of setting up my practice. I mean, this is years in the making. Mm-hmm. And I had to abandon all of it at the last minute because I thought, this isn't going to lend up. And I didn't want to bring that kind of exposure to patients mm-hmm. coming in and going out of my office, because the media was camping outside my office. It had really spun out of control, which was really annoying considering the fact that at that year, approximately 1,800 murders had happened within Wayne County. So the focus was on me. And I'm like, what about all these other homicides, you know? So eventually I pulled up stakes, sold everything, changed my name, moved in the middle of where nobody knew me. And of course, this is before internet, so that was easier to do. Mm-hmm. And I did not speak of it for 30 years.
Wow.
And in the interim, I tried my best to get myself back together. In my training, I had learned the biopsychosocial model. So I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on all three. Biologically, and this is a strong recommendation I have to any other homicide survivor, the first person you should consult is your healthcare practitioner, number one, mm-hmm. assuming you're safe where you are, because you're going to have repercussions. You are. And it's better to get on the forefront of that than afterwards, because mm-hmm. if you don't have your health, if you're not sleeping, nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. So to get myself together physically, I decided to work out at the gym four mornings a week with a group of other women. And we ended up doing triathlons together after about 3 years. And that was a whole nother experience that was really cool to be with, surrounded by people that were that mentality, you know, and drive. Psychologically, I had the podcast, which that was the last of the three that I did. But in 2020, I developed a podcast to meet other homicide survivors. And that was just a breath of fresh air for me, because I felt like I'd met my tribe, like these people could finish my sentence for me. And it was very gratifying. And then sociologically, I traveled the world and I volunteered for projects in very remote places of the world. Both because I thought it would help my teaching, because I taught cross-cultural psychotherapy, but also because I needed that context. I needed to see my situation in a much larger context. And I'll tell you, boy, was that effective, because when I came home, I had a complete pivot. It was like I started thinking about the resources I had and what things had not been changed by the homicide. Mm-hmm. I had taken so many things for granted, like running water, paved roads, flushing toilets, medical providers, legal rights. I could go on. I met people who had horrific things happen to them repeatedly in some cases with zero chance of help. No, in their whole lifetime. Unless they wanted to walk 40 miles to Nairobi and maybe find somebody, but they wouldn't have a way to pay. So it really put a different spin on the whole thing for me. And instead of feeling like I had to lick my wounds, I felt like I had to be grateful for what was going for me. And then, like I said, the last shift was the podcast. And when I met them, there was like no end in sight because they refueled me. And I look at them as experts. They're veterans. They know what it's like. And some people assume I do therapy with them. No. I've learned a lot from them. And I still do. And they're from all walks of life, all parts of the world. And yet we have this membership to this club nobody wants to be a part of. But that's how I got into it. And out of it has come the podcast, a couple of books, and a lot of networking, which is invaluable to me.
So you've kind of built a community with them.
Definitely.
And that's the best kind of support group you can have.
Absolutely.
Having been through that experience, I can't imagine having to go and identify your husband based on remains. What does that do as a psychologist? What does that do to your head, to your mindset?
Well, one thing it does is it takes away any fantasy you might have that this is a mistake, that he'll walk in the door,
Sure.
that they got the wrong guy. But I think it also, of course, really catapults you into more trauma. Although I will say that the detective that accompanied me to the morgue did a superior job, Detective Landeros. She first described what I was going to see. She literally stood by my side and had her hand under my arm to support me throughout the procedure. And she kept saying, all you got to do is say yes or no. That's it, yes or no. She kept it as brief as she could. But today they don't do that as much, you know, because of DNA being what it is today. But it was, you know, ugly. It was 3D. It smelled bad. It looked bad. And then to add to add to the intensity of it, as I was leaving the building, the media were right there and they wanted to shove a microphone in my face to get a clip. What did that, you know? Well, Detective Landero saw them right as we were going out the door and she twirled me around and we went out the back and she put me in her squad car. So saved me that problem. But it's pretty horrific. I think she was very compassionate in the way she handled it, as was everybody else that was there. It was the world that waited outside the morgue that was less that way.
So you mentioned all the other homicides that had happened. Why do you think they did single out yours?
Because it was salacious, because it had all the media doesn't report everything. And when it comes to homicide, there are certain people that cannot get attention. If you're a minority in a dangerous community and you get broken into and you're killed, you probably won't be much in the news because that's like, well, to be expected, in quotes. But in my situation, it involved another psychologist. That's unusual. His body parts were spread on the freeway. That was unusual. I was young and didn't know my rights when it came to them knocking on my door, which I do now. I wish I'd known then what I know now. And it had a salacious angle because one of the two people that ended up being involved, incarcerated for his murder, was a prostitute, a sex worker. And it was rumored he had a relationship with her and was buying her all kinds of things. And then when he ran out of money, they just had no more use for him. So it had a lot of the details that the public craves. I don't blame the media completely. I think it's the public. They drive the train. If it bleeds, it leads. And that's what the public wants to see when it comes to, quote, true crime.
And those true crime shows are all the craze. Everybody loves watching them and seeing all the details. I've never gotten into that because I deal more with the caregiving of people who have been through trauma, who've been through accidents and then need help. That's the side that I tend to lean on. And so from the healer part of me, I'd love to hear what kind of supports you had to help you with any mental issues that may have come from all of that.
None. Keep in mind, this is before the internet.
Sure.
This is before grief therapy. I was living in a town that was, I mean, the newspaper was the size of a folded napkin. So if I could find a mental health practitioner, they would probably have no experience in treating me like this. And secondly, anything I said would be public knowledge in a matter of time because it was
Sure.
such a teeny tiny little place. We didn't even have stoplights. I mean, it was the dusty little patch of a place, but I needed that. I needed the serenity of that rural environment. So, and I'd moved away from my mentor. He was in Detroit, and he had retired right about that very time. In fact, he wanted me to take over the program in our last conversation. And I said, no, I'm leaving. And he said, I am too. And so I didn't have him to rely on. So there was no help. I did go to see my healthcare provider before I left Detroit. And at my urging of my mentor, he said, you've got to start getting some sleep. You've got to get some rest. And I very reluctantly accepted a prescription of a low dose Xanax because I had seen the effects of drug addiction in my practice. And I thought, I ain't going down that road. And my practitioner kept saying, I'm not worried about you becoming a drug addict. Just, I'm giving you 3 pills. Please take them. And it was a very low dose. And the first night I took one, I slept 16 hours. I don't think that's all from the medication. I think it just was able to turn it off. And I'll tell you, the world looked better to me when I woke up after 16 hours of solid rest. It did. It
It's
did.
amazing
And
what sleep
so,
does for our brain.
oh, I had underappreciated it. I felt 5 years younger and like I could see things clearly and attend to things longer. I had so many bruises. In fact, that appointment, I remember when I walked in to see her, I had so many bruises on me. She didn't know me well. And she ironically said to me, are you in a safe relationship? I thought, how do I answer that one?
Well, yeah, good
But that's
question.
from bumping into things. I was so
Sure.
klutzy.
Sure.
That's how, I don't know if everybody's that way when they're under stress, but for me, I was clumsy and I did the stupidest things when I was tired. Like I remember my detergent box had a clump in it, the powdered detergent. And I looked in the box like, oh, there's the clump. That's why it won't come out. And I hit the sides of it with my hand and up it went in my eyeball. I had
Gosh.
this red eye and I'm like, that was stupid. I mean, that's the kind of things I did. Just because I was on, too little sleep.
Yeah. As a brain with lack of sleep is almost as bad as a brain on drugs, if not worse. So, yeah.
That makes
You
sense.
kind of had that experience going.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
felt pretty out of it.
So you needed the sleep for sure. So it sounds like most of your real therapy came from this community that you built.
And that's why it took so long. I mean, this was 40 years ago, and it took so long that when I remarried finally, my husband had to pull this out of me. I did not want to talk about it. All he knew is I was married to somebody who died. And I said, someday I'll tell you about it, little by little. And then when I finally wrote my book and he read it, he goes, now I get it. I just didn't want to talk about it. I'm like, it's exhausting to talk about it with people who've never been through it. And I don't want to be pitied. And I don't want to be gossiped about. And I just zipped it. But boy, when I met other homicide survivors, I could talk openly and easily about it. And they have gotten me to the point where I am today, where I can talk about it without crumbling.
Yeah. Well, I'm thankful that you've gotten to where you are now. So, again, kind of with the background of psychology and having this community, what are some of the common themes of challenges that you see that that survivors like yourself face?
Well, of course, physical, which we just mentioned, it'll exacerbate old problems and bring on new ones. That's a huge one. Another one that may surprise people is the lack of social support. People assume that people will come to your aid, and that doesn't typically happen, at least not enduring assistance. What usually happens is after 2 to 3 months, while the investigation is grinding and the criminal justice system is moving on, people tend to distance themselves from the stigma, from the taint of what happened. And they've gone back to their lives. And that's right about the time you're ready to start talking about it. There's nobody around. They don't know what to offer, so they withdraw. And so one feature of it is lack, you're by yourself a lot of the time. And there's even distancing within a family. And that comes about, I think, in part because people grieve differently and they start blaming each other, like, well, you're not talking about it. Well, all you want to do is talk about it. And how is that constructive? And so on. And tensions are high and people's patience is short. So that's another feature of it. The other thing is that we homicide survivors have so many experts that we're thrust into dealing with all at once, and there's no coordination among them. Mm-hmm. And they have a different vocabulary than we do. We don't understand, you know, the legal terms that are thrown at us. We don't understand the medical terms. We don't understand the investigation terms and all the rules that go along with all of that. And it's left up to us to coordinate all that. And we don't even know what questions to ask. And we come to it not only from a place of ignorance, but a place of misinformation, because, you know, the average person gets their information, let's say, from Law and Order, if the legal system. Well, we don't have a Detective Benson most of the time leading us through it. It isn't the way it is depicted at all. And so a unique and very troubling feature of this is the lack of coordination among helpers, among those with change, who are change agents. It's up to you to figure it out, so that the detective won't know where to send you for a support group, and your therapist can't prepare you for testimony in court, and so on and so forth, so that you're kind of in the middle of all of this mayhem at the very time that you aren't sleeping and you don't have your wits about you, and we don't know your rights. And it's very, you're very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And you're putty in people's hands for a while.
It sounds like it. The closest I can say that to an experience like that has been my experience. I had a TBI last year, and trying to remember all of the things that I needed to do, finding the care providers that I needed, the resources that I needed in the community.
Mm-hmm.
You need somebody to hold your hand through all of those things.
Right.
But
right.
You know, in a lot of these instances, there is not that handholding present. So
no.
You are thrust into this environment where you are not the expert, but you're having to act like one.
Exactly. It's like the one with the least skills in the situation has to be the leader.
Yeah.
It's backwards.
It is. Oh man, it sounds like that we use care coordinators in the hospital, that this whole system needs a care coordinator, somebody that can.
I think of
do that. Being
a homicide survivor is kind of like having an orphan disease.
Yeah.
Because there's not enough research, there's not enough support or understanding, and we're kind of groping in the dark trying to educate the healthcare providers. And I mean that both in terms of physical and mental.
Mm-hmm.
And the attorneys, they don't care about that. They just want a conviction. They'll do and say anything on a witness stand. The stuff that they asked me on the witness stand was horrific and irrelevant. And I wanted to stand up and scold them is what I felt like. You know, like one stupid question was, did you give anybody permission to dissect your husband? I said, he wasn't dissected. He was mutilated. What a stupid question.
Goodness. Definitely not CSI kind of questions. Goodness. With all of that going on, did you have time to grieve?
Not for years, because I was busy fighting off the press. I found out that he had left me $30,000 in debt, which is equivalent to $75,000 today. I had the IRS at my door. I had medical problems as a result. I went into menopause prematurely. I had hair loss, lost weight, insomnia. So I had medical issues to deal with. I had people driving by my house and stealing things, taking pictures of themselves at my front door. Like, oh, look at this, a new crime story right in our neighborhood. Yay. We call those death tourists.
Gotcha.
I had dealing with all that. And then the relocation, trying to find a new job. So the grief was put on hold. I mean, that was like a luxury. That was way down on my emergency list of things to get around to. And so I would say it was a good 2 years before I could really start processing it.
Hmm. With your experience and having talked to other survivors like yourself, is the grief that you finally did experience later on, is that different from other types of grief?
I would say there's an overlap, to be sure. People who die from accident and illness, there's certainly an overlap, but there are some unique features, like with homicide, only 50% of the cases get solved. So, and of those 50% that do not get solved, approximately 80% of those are cases where the body's never found. So how do you grieve? Where do you go if there's just no ending? It's like they walked out the door and they never return. That's pretty unique. Having to identify a mutilated corpse is unique. Having it very public, if you die of cancer, you're not put on a witness stand. So that's and having to witness, you don't, let me put that differently. You don't have to witness it. You can walk out of the courtroom. But if you're in the courtroom, you may witness graphic testimony. And you don't get that with a medical illness typically. I suppose in isolated cases you could. So, and then the other thing is just the pressure that people put on you to be fun, to be over it, to be happy and smiling. Well, it's been a year, and the remarks people will make. In fact, I did a little TikTok post on that last week where I c collapsed a lot of the things people told me and put them in one little episode about, like, this one woman. She was a young widow when her husband was murdered, and somebody said to her, "Well, you're young, you'll find somebody else." And with me, it was like I had somebody come to my garden gate and say, "Well, I think it was a staged suicide, don't you?" I'm like, "What?" And people just will say the oddest things. I think what happens, I think where this stems from in part, besides ignorance, is when you are in the news, people take liberties they wouldn't normally take. They get to feel like they know you. And they'll come up to you in public and say things and ask things that they don't think they would normally do if they didn't, if it wasn't in the news. And they take liberties and they get offended if you don't want to answer them. Like, who are you? I'm not discussing this with you. So you get, so you don't even go out in public anymore. You find people that will run errands for you.
Which 40 years ago was not the same as it is now, where you can just call and
Nothing.
get things delivered.
Or if you're living in a rural area today, I mean, where I live, we have more animal life is my biggest worry. I mean, cougars and stuff. I worry more about that than people. And we don't have Uber Eats. We don't get anything. We can't even get a pizza delivered to our house. So it's not changed everywhere.
Fair enough. Gosh, I don't even know where to go from this one. My next question that I wanted to ask is, what advice do you have for someone who might be experiencing this? But sounds like you have so much more even than just that.
Well, I would put at the top of my list to go see a healthcare provider. Hopefully, you have an established relationship with one. You need to do that earlier rather than later. I put that in my book. First thing, number one, once you're safe, once you know that the supporters of the accused are not after you, then you need to go and perhaps be accompanied, but go. That's number one. The other thing too is to pay attention to your physical health, pay attention to your safety, and pull in a friend. Friends often want to help, but they don't have a clue what to do. And there's so many things they can do to help you. For example, you need a prescription. Would you go out and pick up my prescription? You have an appointment for your cat to go to the vet. Could you run my cat to the vet? Can you make sure that my doors are locked at night? Because I'm not thinking clearly. Can you make sure my car's locked at night? Because I'm not thinking clearly. And if you really trust somebody, what you can do is have them become a spokesperson when the media comes knocking at your door, and to say, "Here's the things that are off limits. You will not discuss my children. You will not discuss where we're headed," or whatever it is that you want to say is off limits, and or give them a script to write, and say, "Just read this and don't accept questions." Or if you want them to accept questions, fine. But have a family spokesperson. Could be a doesn't have to be a friend. It could be an attorney. It could be someone else. But I would recommend that rather than dealing with the media yourself. And then post a big note on your door saying, "No more media. Don't knock. Don't call. Don't ring the doorbell. Goodbye." Because you do not owe them that. You don't. I would recommend that if you're going to have a funeral, make it a private funeral. And there's It's kind of a lot to get into, but there's ways to make it private so that, because I didn't do that. I didn't know that you could do that. And there was more media there than I think relatives, and it was awful. They need to feel back in the driver's seat, back in control. And there's ways that they can go about it, especially with the help of a friend. Make a friend making sure you eat, even preparing you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is more than you're going to do. I went 3 days without eating. I didn't even occur to me to eat. I wasn't hungry. My parents finally flew in and she said, "You know, frankly, you need a shower. I don't know when the last time is that you," because subjectively, it didn't feel like 3 days. It felt like one long day with cat naps. I wasn't even aware that 3 days had passed. It was just one long day. And when they came in, they're like, "First, you get a shower. I'm going to fix you something to eat. And then you're going to go take a nap." You need that kind of structure because you're just vulnerable. You're not yourself. Like you say, it's like somebody who's had drugs or something.
And because I have a lot of healthcare professionals listening, are there any tips that you would give to the healthcare professional, the nurse, the doctor that might have to help take care of the survivor after this?
I guess one thing is do not be too timid. Do not feel that we are made out of glass and that you can't ask us pointed questions. Because whatever we've seen or heard, our imagination has probably even made it even uglier. So don't treat us like with kid gloves. You don't have to do that. I'm not saying be rude in our face, but I think there's a common theme of, "Oh, I don't want to get into the, oh, this is an ugly thing." No. We need somebody who can sit there and remain calm and be unafraid and be at our side through this. So, in my situation, I would have loved it if I had a healthcare provider ask me, "What was the toughest part of this whole ordeal for you? And how can I help you? And what are you ruminating about?" Those are personal questions, but if I trust the person, I'll talk about it, you know? But most people treat you like you're going to ex implode or something. And you don't need that. You need somebody who's steady, who has one foot on the outside that you trust. And then to even if they don't know where to refer you, to say, "I don't know where to refer you, but I'm going to find out. And I'll be back in touch with you within 24 hours." And nowadays, we have many more ability, and there's much more ability to find support than there was back in 85. But make sure that you hand us off to an appropriate source like Homicide Inc., INC, or there's a group called Compassionate Friends. If it's a child that's been murdered, then you can refer us to Parents of Murdered Children. And then the buzzword would be a trauma-informed mental health care provider. That make sure their credentials are right. That would be of tremendous help too.
All good tips. So tell me a little bit about the book. Every time I talk to somebody who's written a book about their experience, it's like a therapy in itself.
For me, I decided to wait for 30 years so it wouldn't be, because I didn't want my therapy to be at the expense of my readership. So my first book is called The Life Divided, and it was a true crime memoir, but I also spent a portion of it, at the last maybe third of it, speaking to generally other homicide survivors. I wanted to get my ducks in a row before I wrote the book. I wanted to get enough distance from it in terms of years to be able to be accurate in my perspective so that I wasn't using it as therapy. I would say my podcast was more therapeutic for me than that. My second book, however, that's a reference book. And I poured all my resources and knowledge and experts in to get that accomplished. It could have been three volumes, but I limited it to 450 pages. And it's written longitudinally. It starts with the death notification, dealing with the investigators, dealing with the funeral personnel, going to see your healthcare provider, making sure you're safe. What friends can do to help, on down the line to grieving and children, what to expect in terms of social stigma, parole, advocacy at the very end is the last chapter. And it's packed with all kinds of resources, books that are written. That's another thing people can do is to read first person accounts of people who've had very similar situations. Like Beautiful Ashes is a wonderful book. It was written by a young woman, she was actually in her teens when her mother was murdered by her father, and then he burned the house down. Boy, you talk about an inside glimpse of domestic violence and how everybody dropped the ball around her. Here's just one example. She was put on the witness stand against her father and then had to go home with him at night because he wasn't even arrested.
Oh my
Living with
goodness.
him for She lived with him for 3 years, knowing he murdered her mother. And he knew she knew. Talk about putting her in jeopardy.
No kidding.
Yeah, so the
Wow.
craziest things happen, you know?
Wow.
So, reading first-person accounts can be helpful. And I also want to put in a plug, by the way, for the Innocence Project. I'm very involved with them. And the reason I want to do that is because most homicide survivors are so angry and wanting a conviction that they go into that courtroom wanting blood, and they're not objective. They need to leave room for the possibility that this person is innocent. I know that's horrific sounding, but the last thing we need is an innocent person convicted of that murder, because then the real murderer is free. And there's a great book on that called Getting Life. And Mike Morton, who wrote the book, was a homicide survivor who was wrongly convicted in the murder of his wife, served 25 years in maximum security, lost his son, who was adopted out in the process. And then at the other end, it's like, oh, geez, sorry, me bad. Go
Like a
on
real
about your
life Shaw,
life.
like a real life
Yeah.
Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah. And it happens. And so we need to back off. We as a society need to back off. And because the pressure we put on DAs to get a conviction at all costs, or the police to get a conviction at all costs, results in some pretty awful things like making of a murderer. We don't need that. We want to get the right people behind bars. So please think about that before you go in there wanting convictions at all costs. Now, the guy in my situation, he got up and bragged about what he'd done on the witness stand. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Wow.
Yeah, he just thought, oh, well, I'm going to go to prison. I might as well brag on it. Because if he bragged on it, then when he got incarcerated, people would leave him alone. Because if he went into detail about what he did with my husband's body, well, people aren't going to mess with you behind bars knowing what you're capable of.
Jeez.
Because most murders are not, don't involve throwing body parts on the freeway, you know.
Wow. So you are helping so many people through the books, through your community, through your
I hope that's
podcast.
my wish. That's my wish.
My hope with my podcast is always that if one person gets helped by this show, then it was a success. But I would assume that you're helping way more than just that one person.
Well, I'm gratified to learn that my podcast is heard in 22 countries,
Nice.
and it's now in its 5th year. I have met the most amazing people from all walks of life. People who have been met with adversity, like just horrific things have happened to them. And yet here they are, sane and sound and wanting to help. My hat's off to them. And they're the unsung heroes that we don't hear about, and we need to. And I want, for many of them, it's the first time they've spoken publicly about it. And I just revel in their success. I'm so proud of them, and I'm so grateful to them for their willingness to step up to the plate and talk. And that's what I get from it, is I, you know, every year I think, do I want to do it another year? And I look back on the people I met and I go, yeah, I will.
It's good work that you're doing. So I
Thank
thank you
you.
for all that, and thank you for sharing today. How can people find you if they want to learn more about any of what we're discussing today?
Well, I'm on TikTok pretty regularly, at the urging of my daughter, who said, Mom, you're missing out. I'm like, I don't know. I don't even watch TikToks, but okay. So she got me up and running, bless her heart. And I'm on TikTok pretty regularly. But also I tried to put everything in one place, which is my website, which is www.jancantiphd.com. And on there, like I said, there's a list of resources. I have a blog that I started last year. And I have things on there like some of the crap that is being pulled by crime scene cleanup companies and how to avoid it. The exploitation that they put us through. They'll video before and after video of the crime scene and then put it on YouTube and make money off of you. Well, we don't know that, you know. So I put tips on the blog. I have the books. I have the podcast. And I've occasionally done speaking engagements.
Excellent. And I will
And been
include,
other people's and been on other people's podcasts.
yes, very good. I'll include those links in the show notes too so that people can
Okay.
find you easily. But thank you so much for being here today. This was
You're
a
welcome.
very great conversation.
Can I end with my favorite quote?
Absolutely.
It's from Helen Keller, and she said, "Although the world is full of suffering, it is also filled with the overcoming of it."
Perfect way to end the show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Brain Wellness, the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I encourage you to subscribe, like, and share this with others to help me continue on with my mission to help people live healthier, happier lives. Go to www.brainwellnesssolutions.com to see what I'm up to and get links to all the social medias there. See you next time.